approached quietly, and it remained still until she was a meter away. Then it swelled up, puffed its feathers, and seemed to sigh without lifting its head from its chest. It blinked, and its beak glinted faintly in the dark. The wing was beyond repair. A bit of bone protruded from the black feathers, which were stripped away by the cat's claws, revealing a patch of bluish reptilian skin. They stared for some time together. It observed her with a wariness, even intelligence. Wind rustled the trees. Marianne hunched inside her jacket, chilly despite the night's warmth. The bird would die here alone in the darkness. Would it gradually starve? Or would the cat return to finish it off? Or some other night creature? A fox or weasel or barn owl? She did not want to leave it. "You are not alone," she thought. "Don't be afraid. You are beloved." And the words filled her mind, big enough to transcend and spread out into the night. Marianne was not a religious person, but she felt the presence of something divine. The bird was an angel. The bird was Albrecht. No, she realized with star-bright clarity. It was Connie. She spread her coat on the grass and lay down beside it. And at some point, she drifted off to sleep. When she woke in the first gray light of dawn, the bird was gone, and Connie was dead. Chapter 6. Berg Lingenfels, July 1945. Lying in her cot at Berg Lingenfels, Benita did not open Connie's letter. Through her sickness, its presence on the bedside table exerted a ghoulish force. In her dreams, she would try to read it, but the words swam before her eyes, long and ponderous, so obscure as to be incomprehensible, or worse, dull. No sense would shake from its folds. And Connie himself hovered at the periphery of her sleep. She saw him across a crowded party or at the end of a hall, or even in the shadows here in her room, but it was impossible to connect. He would be engrossed in conversation with a colleague, or flirting with another woman, or simply slip out of her sight as she approached. When she woke, sweaty with fever, rattled by stress, she wanted nothing to do with his letter, and blamed it for her nightmares. "I love you. I'm sorry." It didn't matter what he said. Their marriage was what it was, and now it was over. Connie was dead. "Can you put this away somewhere?" Benita asked Elizabeth one night, when the girl came to deliver her evening soup in Marianne's place.
"Where?"
Elizabeth asked. She was a stolid, literal girl and did not seem surprised. Benita cast her eyes around the bare room.
"Anywhere that I don't have to see it," she answered.
So Elizabeth stuck it in the chest of drawers that housed Benita's few possessions. And after that, Benita's sleep improved. Benita had been sick for 3 weeks when she woke to find a strange man in her room. Her first thought was of what she must look like. The edges of her mouth were dry and cracked, and her nightgown sweat-stained. The sheets lay twisted at her feet. She scrambled to cover herself and became light-headed with the effort. Marianne, who had come in with the stranger, was rustling open the ancient window and made no move to assist her.
"This is Herr Müller," she said,
turning back to Benita, who remained huddled on the cot.
"He has come to help around the castle today, and I thought he could begin by taking you outside. The sun will do you good."
Benita stared at Marianne.
"Could I..."
She clutched the open neck of her nightgown.
"Could I have a minute first to dress?"
"Ah, of course,"
Marianne said.
"Herr Müller, would you give us a moment?"
It was so like Marianne to act first and then think. Even in the days of sickness, Vinita recognized this. Marianne had no patience for mundane concerns like appearance or propriety.
"Who is he?"
Vinita managed to ask as Marianne helped her tug a pair of trousers on under her nightdress.
"A prisoner," Marianne said brusquely. "Someone the Americans sent."
Her tone forbade more questions. A German. But Vinita had already recognized this. When he re-entered the room, head slightly bowed and eyes averted, Vinita felt a wave of shame. He was a good-looking man, too thin for his large frame, with a bold, strong-featured face and a square forehead. He seemed to understand her embarrassment. It confirmed that she was right to feel self-conscious. Sickness and the war had made her ugly and broken down. But when he lifted her, easily, as if she were an armload of feather ticking, she felt unaccustomedly feminine. The gingerness of his touch, the careful placement of his hand so that it would not brush against her breast, the heat of his forearm under her thighs brought something dormant in her to life. As her light, hot head bounced against his shoulder, she was filled with a sense of relief. His manner projected competence. In his arms, she felt like a baby picked up and collected by its mother, purring with the pleasure of being held. To her embarrassment, her eyes filled with tears. "Are you all right?" he asked as he navigated the curving stone stairs, and she nodded, unable to speak. Outside, he laid her on a straw mattress underneath the chestnut tree. The sun was beautiful and dappled, and the breeze brushed across her cheek like a breath, lifting her shorn hair from her scalp. She was not chilled and aching or struggling for breath, and she was filled with wonder at her own painlessness. "Is this a good place?" the man asked, bringing her back to the moment.
"Thank you,"
she managed to say, nodding. His eyes glanced up at hers then, shockingly blue, like one of those eerie northern dogs, light rather than the deep water blue of Connie's. And something like recognition, only sharper, passed between them.
"Why are you here?"
she wanted to ask. But then Martin came running, her sweet, lovely boy, his cheeks pink from play, his forehead sweaty. He crouched before her and she lifted a hand to his face. The beautiful child she had lost and found. And she forgot all about the man who had just carried her down. For the next few weeks, Herr Müller helped Vinita downstairs every time he came to the castle, first carrying her, and then, as her strength returned, supporting her as she walked. He was not a talker, but she questioned him anyway. He was from Braunschweig, a city not far from where she had grown up, which perhaps explained his familiarity. Before the war, he had been a carpenter. He had a daughter and a father still living in the home he had left.
"And your wife?"
she asked, knowing she was being forward. His wife was dead. Mostly they proceeded in silence, which Vinita did not feel pressured to fill. She found his quiet steadiness comforting. He reminded her of the men of Frühlinghausen, men who worked with their hands and ate dinner in silence, men like her father, a quiet, hulking presence in her childhood, falling asleep in his chair after dinner, with his red hands splayed like slabs of meat on his knees. She had spent her girlhood scheming to escape such men. But now, in Herr Müller's presence, she found she missed the way they made her feel. As she regained her strength, she began taking short trips around the castle, to the stables, the bakehouse, the kitchen garden. It had been so long since she'd been free to walk where she wanted. The openness of the countryside, the smell of summer grasses,
The clouds of dust on the road were all suddenly beautiful to her. The war had quashed any romantic notions she once held of the city. On one of these walks, she came across Herr Müller piling split wood under the eave of a dilapidated outbuilding that had once been the castle brewery.
"Frau Fledermann," he said, straightening. "Are you well enough to walk all this way? On your own?"
"Of course," she said through her breathlessness. It had, in fact, been a little far.
"Ah!"
Müller looked uncertain. He mopped the sweat off his brow.
"Here,"
he said, leveling the stack of logs in the wheelbarrow and spreading his jacket over the top.
"Sit a minute and catch your breath."
Light-headed, Benita complied. She could feel the sweat running under her arms and standing at the edge of her hairline. The barrow was in the shade of the building, and beyond this, the sun was hot. Two huge dragonflies hung and swooped, attached head to tail across this boundary of shadow and light. Müller regarded Benita with concern. His pose struck her as clownish, this large man, peering at her so tentatively.
"I went to carnival in Braunschweig once," she offered impulsively, "with my troupe, my BDM cluster."
As she spoke, she remembered the parade, the colorful floats of costumed dancers and local school groups, business associations and social clubs. There were giant papier-mâché caricatures of knights and princesses, tableaus of political figures and folktale characters. And everywhere the smells of beer, crisp potato pancakes, sausages, and sugary doughnuts. She had gone with a group of classmates, and they had schemed to meet their future husbands.
Schorduvel,
they called carnival in Braunschweig. Scare the devil. The city had seemed huge and magical and dangerous.
"Huh?"
Müller smiled, and Benita felt him relax. He leaned back against the wood he had stacked.
"It was wonderful," she said. "Did you go every year?"
"When I was a boy."
"And not after?"
"And sometimes after."
He smiled again, now looking sheepish.
"Of course," she said. "Why wouldn't you? Did you ride the Ferris wheel?"
"Always."
"It was amazing, wasn't it?"
She remembered the rocking, and the exhilarating sense of danger that was not actually danger at all.
"I would have done it a million times if I could."
"And then come down for a Weissbier and a plate of Kartoffelpuffer?"
"Exactly."
Benita smiled. Companionable silence passed between them.
"I was the carnival princess in Frühlinghausen once," she said.
Müller raised his eyebrows and tipped an imaginary cap, bowing his head.
"Your Highness?"
"Did you have one in Braunschweig?"
"The mayor's wife."
He puffed out his cheeks.
"Too fat to ride in the parade carriage?"
Benita laughed. The dragonflies darted into the sun, frightened by the sound.
"It feels impossible now, doesn't it?"
she said, and then wished she hadn't. The words invited melancholy.
"Never mind,"
she shook her head.
"I should start back or Marianne will worry."
She extended her hand to Müller.
"Will you help me stand?"
He bowed slightly.
"Gnädige Princess."
At dinner, Benita found the courage to mention Herr Müller. It was a change from their usual topic of conversation, whom Marianne had received a letter from and where they were. She was engaged in a quest-like search for other widows like Benita, the lost wives and mothers and faithful secretaries, a category Benita found deeply suspicious, of Connie and Albrecht's fellow conspirators. Even now, with the country's infrastructure in shambles,
Marianne managed to exchange letters and telegrams with friends and acquaintances from all over. Mostly these were women Benita didn't know or had felt snubbed by because she was so young, so uneducated, so unfitting a bride for Connie. But there were others still missing from Marianne's careful catalog. The wives of men on the outskirts of the group, beyond Marianne's social circles.
How long will the Americans keep their prisoners?
Benita managed to ask before Marianne could get started on the subject. Marianne glanced up from serving the soup, a tasteless cabbage and carrot and potato that neither she nor Benita knew how to improve.
I don't know, Marianne said. I think they'll be sent to France for the rebuilding.
The terrible ones, Elizabeth said.
Really?
Fritz asked, wide-eyed. The boy had a grim fascination with all the most horrible details emerging about the Nazis. Psychopaths like Josef Kramer, the Beast of Belsen, as they now referred to him. A man who had personally gassed 80 Jews for his collection of skeletons.
Elizabeth, Marianne scolded, you have no idea who they send where. Don't give your brother wrong-headed facts.
She turned to Benita.
Why do you ask?
I was just thinking of Herr Müller,
Benita ventured.
Ah,
Marianne frowned.
I haven't asked Peterman how long he'll be here, but we can get by without him, certainly.
Of course,
Benita nodded.
They can't keep these prisoners forever, Marianne continued. Too expensive. They'll need them to get back to work.
But I like Herr Müller, Fritz said petulantly. I don't want him to be released.
Elizabeth shot her brother a look.
Do you hear what you're saying? You sound like Rapunzel's stepmother. If you like someone, you should want them to be free.
The next week, a heat wave settled over Berglingenfels. A shaggy animal brushing against the hills, panting along the river, quieting the birds and making the castle sweat. The ditches were alive with milkweed, nettles, and creeping phlox. In the warmth, the forest looked soft and dense, a black lump against blue sky. Benita decided she was well enough to walk down to the farm of Herr Kellermann, the castle caretaker, for the eggs he supplied. She had imagined going with Martin, walking down the hillside with her long-lost son, continuing their reacquaintance, which was still a work in progress. He was a different boy than the one the Nazis had taken from her. At 6, he seemed a young person rather than a child. But he had wanted to stay with Fritz. So Benita walked alone. On her way, she noticed a figure below. Herr Kellermann, maybe. But the person was too tall to be Kellermann, and walked without a limp. As she watched, the figure became clear. It was Herr Müller. She smiled and lifted her hand. He returned the greeting, though neither of them called out. She heard nothing but the sound of the warm wind in her ears. When he finally reached her, he stopped and removed his cap.
"Are you going to Berglingenfels?" she asked.
He nodded.
"But it isn't Thursday."
She lifted a hand to shield the sun from her eyes. She could smell the dust and sweat on his clothes.
"I came to give you something,"
he said, reaching into his pockets.
"I made these for the boys."
In his hand, he held two wooden soldiers. Intriguing, roughly carved figures, each around the size of a carrot.
"So beautiful,"
Benita said.
"Take them."
He held out his hand. She hesitated. Marianne would not like her to accept a gift from him. She did not like Herr Müller. This much was obvious.
"I don't think,"
she began.
"I don't think Frau von Lingenfels would like it."
The smile on his face faded and he looked down the hill. Vinita regretted her words.
Never mind, she said swiftly. She doesn't have to know.
Muller regarded her. I don't want to make trouble.
With growing conviction, Vinita smiled. She slid the soldiers into her pockets, one on each side.
They will make the boys happy.
Herr Muller smiled back, and she felt her old self stir. The Vinita who knew how to make a man smile.
Chapter 7 Berglingenfels, August 1945. Marianne did not discover the toy soldiers for some time, and then only because she was looking for the cat. The animal had appeared one day outside the kitchen door, an ugly thing, half its tail missing, unbeautifully brindled. Cats were rare these days, starved or worse. Rumor had it that people in the bombed-out cities ate them. But this one was brave and proud and unafraid. The girls fed it scraps from a bowl they left beside the kitchen steps. So now the cat was probably better fed than most of Germany's children. Then, suddenly, it stopped coming. The scraps lay in the bowl uneaten, picked over by the birds, which then twittered and shat all over the kitchen stoop. The girls were beside themselves.
Stop worrying about that creature, Marianne chided them. Don't create drama.
But secretly she worried too. There was something cheering about the cat's pluckiness. Even Martin liked to play with it. It brought a certain lightness to their makeshift family, and its absence seemed unaccountable. It was far too pragmatic a creature to forsake such a good situation. So Marianne went looking. Perhaps it was trapped somewhere. God knows the old stables and barns were full of dangerous rotting floorboards and menacing holes. This was what brought her to the stable. When she entered, she was surprised to hear Fritz and Martin. Since Martin's accident, they were forbidden to play here. She followed the sound to the back of the building and found them sprawled in a patch of sun. At her approach, they looked up guiltily, and Fritz tucked something behind his back.
What are you doing here? Marianne asked. Just playing, Fritz said. With what?
She extended her hand.
May I see?
Fritz did not move.
Here.
It was Martin who placed his carved soldier in her palm. Marianne frowned. The little figure was beautiful, carved with rough tools, but still quite detailed. A soldier crouching with a rifle. Reluctantly, Fritz handed her his as well. A soldier standing at attention, wearing a long coat.
They're lovely, she said,
confused by the boy's diffidence.
Where did you get them?
Neither spoke.
My mother, Martin finally said. Why such long faces?
Marianne laughed.
I thought you had something terrible. Did you think you weren't allowed to play? Tante Benita said not to show you,
Fritz blurted.
She said you wouldn't like it because Herr Muller made them.
Marianne's face fell.
Ah, she said. I see.
In her palm, the figures suddenly seemed heavy and sharp, their forms weirdly undefined.
Well, you have them now. I won't take them away. But in the future...
She broke off. What did she want to say? Don't listen to Benita. Don't take gifts from a Nazi. Don't hide things from me.
In the future, you are not to visit with Herr Muller, she finished. Don't!
She raised a hand at the protest she knew Fritz was forming.
I don't want to hear your complaints.
Marianne brooded over this all afternoon. So Benita had cast her in the role of righteous humbug, and about something you couldn't expect two young boys to understand. And what was worse, Benita was right.
Marianne didn't approve, and Marianne didn't want Herr Müller making things for the children. She didn't want him working his way into their family. Benita had known that, and had given the toys to the boys anyway. It was bad enough that they hung around Müller as he worked, that they spent hours in the woods watching him split wood, talking about God knows what. The man was a prisoner of war, an ex-Nazi, and she knew nothing of his character. She did not want him playing a paternal role for these fatherless boys. She had been wrong to accept his help. It wasn't until that evening that Marianne remembered the cat and went looking again. But like half the living creatures on the continent, it could not be found. The following day, Marianne went to Lieutenant Petermann.
"I should have asked for Franz Müller's file before I accepted his help," she said, standing before the man's cluttered desk.
Petermann looked amused. "His file," he said, leaning back in his chair. "Do you think we're as organized as the Nazis?"
Marianne frowned. "Well, presumably he has filled out a Fragebogen."
Petermann sighed and turned to one of the overstuffed cabinets behind him. He opened a drawer and began rummaging. The Fragebogen was a questionnaire the Allied occupiers used for denazification. It consisted of 6 pages of questions, ranging from height and weight to membership in the Nazi Party, and whether the subject had ever been involved in the destruction of Jewish property. No one thought highly of it, including the Allies. What was to stop people from lying? But Marianne saw its value. Weren't most Germans too literal and unimaginative to lie? And how else were the Allies supposed to begin sorting ordinary Mitläufer fellow travelers from true Nazi criminals? But apparently she was nearly alone in this sentiment. Even Petermann took a dim view of the forms, which were proving a great hassle for the Americans to process.
"Miraculous!"
he announced, pulling a slim packet of stapled papers from the drawer.
"Here it is Fragebogen."
He extended it to her.
"For what it's worth, God knows what people make up on these things."
Marianne scanned the pages. Address, birthday, education. He had finished school at 14. Party membership. Joined 1942. Member of the reserve. And then there it was, on the third page.
Ordnungspolizei, District Kiel, District Mecklenburg, District Lublin.
Her eyes stuck on the word Lublin. That was where Freddy Lederer had been.
"Not good," Petermann asked, seeing her face. "Let me see."
He took the papers from her hand and looked them over.
"Not even a member of the party until 42. Probably because they made him when he was called up,"
he said, flicking his finger against the page.
"A nobody. I wouldn't have sent you one of the real crazies."
Marianne shook her head. In her mind's eye, she saw Freddy's face again. A sweet, unserious man transformed by despair. The Jewish action he had witnessed was carried out by a unit of the Ordnungspolizei. All those children marched into the woods holding their mother's hands. Concern spread over Petermann's face as he watched her.
"Did he do something to you?"
"No." Marianne looked at him. "But they did terrible things in Lublin."
"Ah."
Petermann looked confused. He stared at the paper, searching for information that would clarify her response. Finding nothing, he lifted his eyes to hers.
"So what do you want me to do?"
Marianne stared at him.
"Tell him to finish chopping whatever trees he has felled," she said, "and then not to come back."
Petermann sighed.
"He's being transferred to a French camp at the end of the month anyway."
Marianne leveled her gaze.
"Tell him."
Every day, the American and British radio programs broadcast new and grisly stories about the Nazis and the horrors of the camps they had liberated. But almost no one listened. The citizens of Erenheim made excuses. They had no radios, no money for newspapers. They were too busy clearing rubble, rustling up food, mourning their dead. Or they maintained that it was all Allied propaganda.
Look at how the Americans treated their German prisoners, locking them in open-air cages along the Rhine, they argued. What was the difference?
Marianne was enraged by their disinterest. Didn't they want to know what happened in the camps? Especially if, as they all insisted, they didn't already? Anyway, the idea that they had been ignorant was hogwash. Wasn't that why the German troops had fought until the bitter end? And why the Erenheimers had holed up in the castle, terrified of the advancing Americans? They were afraid they would be punished for their country's sins. Goebbels and Himmler and Hitler himself had all but spelled it out in their absurd exhortations over the past year and a half. Fight until the bitter end or pay the price. For what we've done was implicit. They had known, but not known. That was closer to the truth. That was something Marianne understood. In any case, she and her children listened to the radio. They needed to understand what their fathers had died fighting, especially Fritz, whose sense of right and wrong was fickle at best. They listened to reports of rotting piles of bodies, gas chambers, and sadistic guards, and of the arrests of high-ranking Nazis, like Ilse Koch, the wife of the commander of Buchenwald, rumored to have turned the skin of executed Jewish prisoners into lampshades. In Nuremberg, Josef Kramer and 45 other camp guards and workers were set to go on trial in September. Grisly pictures of camp victims ran in the papers, side by side with glamorous photos of Irma Gräser, a sadistic concentration camp guard, rumored to be Kramer's mistress. Could you see a person's soul in their face? Marianne and Albrecht had often argued about this. Yes, she had insisted. Didn't you know from the moment you saw Hitler's photograph that he was bad? Albrecht wasn't sure. If it was so obvious, he pointed out, how did he fool the rest of Germany? Some people are better than others at reading the signs, Marianne had said with a shrug. She was half-joking, half-serious. The conversation came back to her when she saw the photos of Irma Gräser. The image on the paper's front page was of a woman who could have been a starlet, with her coy smile and stylish hairdo, while the mugshot inside revealed a repellent bully with a look of stupid hardness in her eyes. The same person, seen two ways. But even in the first one, if you looked closely, you could see the cruelty at the edge of her mouth and the meanness in her gaze. And this was the version that sold papers. In town, the Americans were showing a film, footage of the liberation of Buchenwald. Everyone was required to attend except Opfers. Marianne went anyway. Wasn't it her and every German's responsibility? She made a demonstration out of her commitment, standing tall and solemn at the front of the line. She already knew, of course. But it was one thing to know from documents and stories, horrifying in their own right, and another to see. When the movie began, Marianne had to dig her nails into her palms to keep from throwing up. Here on the screen were actual bodies, heaped like scraps of fabric. Here were fathers and mothers and children, starving and naked, lying in piles. Here were victims staring into the camera as individuals with all the sadness and despair of unique lives. For all the horrors of the official reports she and Albrecht had seen, with their language of extermination and elimination, they could not come close to conjuring this. How could they? There was no point of reference. Later,
Such footage would come to be so familiar it became unseen, a kind of placeholder for human evil. The first black-and-white glimpse of barbed wire, dirt, and nakedness cautioned viewers. Look away. But in this moment, in the first unveiling, it was like nothing she or anyone else had ever seen, and it was impossible to look away. She looked and trembled in her seat. Exiting the theater, two girls walked in front of Marianne. Young women, really, maybe 16 and 17. As they jostled through the doors in the midst of the solemn crowd, Marianne overheard them talking about silk stockings. One of them had ruined her last pair. Now, where would she ever get new ones? She pouted. Not from the Jews, the other said, and they both giggled.
For shame, Marianne spat. Have you become such monsters that you can laugh at that?
The girls stared at her, not with shame or anger, but with fear. And all around her, Marianne felt the people draw close together, tightening their scarves and jackets, squaring their shoulders, fortifying themselves against her reproach. A rumor had developed in Erlenheim and elsewhere that the film was a piece of Allied propaganda and that the footage really showed German soldiers and collaborators killed and starved in Soviet gulags. In the last months of the war, the Americans had dropped leaflets with photos of concentration camp victims from airplanes, and this was how Hitler had explained them. Being the sheep they were, the Erlenheimers believed him. And they clung to this idea now, a thin protection between them and their own complicity. It made Marianne livid with fury and shame. Unlike Marianne, Benita did not go see the film, and she stopped listening to the news broadcasts with the von Lingenfelses.
Och,
she said with a shudder on the third night when she joined them sitting around the radio. The subject was the liberation of Mauthausen, another concentration camp.
Do you really think the children should hear this?
Benita asked. Marianne turned and stared at her.
Of course they should. They're Germans.
The children fidgeted in their seats. Even Elisabeth knew better than to interject. Cowed, Benita returned to her darning and listened to the rest of the broadcast in silence. But the following night she begged off. She was too tired to listen and was going to bed. Marianne bit her tongue. Where was Benita's sense of moral responsibility? Where was her compassion? She seemed to have no feeling of commitment to or belonging in the wider world. She was as bad as the citizens of Erlenheim. Marianne's anger rose as suddenly as a flock of startled birds.
Connie had loved Benita, she reminded herself. She was the mother of Connie's son. This was what mattered.
But it was so difficult not to judge. Some deep seed in Marianne's being grew unstoppably toward fairness, pushing blindly through nuance and complication to extract a simple answer. Wrong or right? As a girl, roaming the Ostsee with Connie and Freddy and the other children of the Prussian aristocracy, she had been christened the Judge. In the anarchic atmosphere of the summer holidays, the children had turned to Marianne to sort out their quarrels and issues of fairness. She had loved the role. It made her feel distinguished and powerful. And it was because of this privileged place she held that she and Connie grew close. He was a leader of the group, too, an inventor of the best games and most exciting adventures, a charismatic Pied Piper to the children of the Grand Hotel. In the absence of nannies and governesses, who were instructed by their parents' overlords to let children return to nature on these holidays, Connie and Marianne reigned together, king and queen of the wild things, Connie full of mischief, and Marianne, at 14, full of wisdom. But then her role became a prison as the age of flirtation descended, and Marianne found herself locked out of its frivolities. Her reputation made her self-conscious. How could the judge bat her eyelashes and giggle? How could she feign the silliness necessary to play such games? She was not well suited to flirtation in a physical sense, either. She was tall and dark and awkwardly proportioned, with coltish long limbs, a flat chest, and a somber face.
Even so, Marianne imagined that her connection to Connie was meant to transition into something more adult, more gendered, more romantic. What exactly that entailed, she did not consider, but she believed it was a given, as confusing as it was promising. Then one night their little group went swimming in the moonlight. There was a ball at the hotel and all the adults were swept up in the excitement. It was a hot night, and the ballroom was fetid with the stink of alcohol and perfume, waxy hothouse lilies and sweat. The children escaped to the beach, stripping their clothes as they went, giddy with the excitement of transgression. The sand was still warm from the sun, and the Baltic looked especially soft in the windless darkness, the waves barely lapping at their toes. One by one they plunged into the water, laughing and calling out. For most, the swim was quick. Despite the calm, they were frightened of the blackness, and they charged back up the dunes to pull on their dresses, shirts, and trousers, crouching and shrieking at the prospect of being seen naked. But Marianne and Connie remained. They swam as if it were a competition to see who would turn back first. When she finally stopped, her heart pounding, she became aware of her body, naked below the surface, suspended precariously over the depths. Connie noticed and turned and swam back to her, emerging nearby, shaking the water from his hair. Above them, stars twinkled through the haze, and in the distance, the hotel sparkled like a cruise ship. For a moment, Marianne was terrified of their distance from the shore and of the unknown deep, but also of Connie, her own nakedness, and her certainty that this was the moment that would change their relationship. Her whole body thrilled with anticipation. But just as she began to swim in his direction, he dove under the water.
"I won,"
he called when he surfaced farther away. Then, with confident, lazy strokes, he started toward the shore. One afternoon, Benita, Caterina, and Elizabeth returned from town, flush-faced and laughing, their light moods discordant with Marianne's.
"You have a note from Herr Petermann," Elizabeth exclaimed.
She held out a thin envelope.
"Maybe we're invited to one of their parties."
Elizabeth was preoccupied with the thought of attending an American army event and dancing with a soldier. Where did she get these ideas? Benita? The doltish Ehrenheim girls she had recently met? She was only 13. Marianne took the envelope and tore it open. It was not an invitation, but something of far more import.
"We have identified the wife of the late Pietra Grabarek, whose name is on your list. Her name is Anya Grabarek, and she is accompanied by two sons. She is currently at the Tolingen Displaced Persons Camp."
The news was exciting but also puzzling. Grabarek was a Polish name, and one Marianne did not immediately recognize, but apparently she had given it to Petermann. She had lifted the names directly from Albrecht's journal, and not all his associates and contacts were known to her. She felt a pang of disappointment that it was not someone she knew. Carlotta Biedermann, for example, whom she had always liked and had lost track of completely. But this was selfish. The list was not about providing her with friends. It was about finding the women she had sworn to help. She read the note aloud.
"Oh," Elizabeth harrumphed in disappointment, "I thought it was an invitation."
The children did not understand their mother's quest,
They were, in fact, discomfited by it. Now that school had begun, such as it was, taught by the sorriest lot of old maids and barely literate numbskulls, all the old teachers had been defrocked as fervent Nazis, this being Ehrenheim. They were surrounded by people who mourned Hitler in secret and viewed Albrecht as a traitor. The children craved distance from their father's reputation.
"Who is Anya Grabarek?" Katerina asked politely. "I don't know,"
Marianne confessed.
"Do you remember him, Benita?" "Pietro Grabarek."
Benita shook her head with disinterest. Of course Benita didn't remember. The girl had no interest in politics.
"The wife of Pietro Grabarek,"
Marianne mused aloud. Suddenly an image came to her. A short man, dark-haired, bearing urgent news. He had brought word of Kristallnacht as it was unfolding across Germany. A Polish envoy, or some sort of diplomat, an associate of Connie's rather than Albrecht's.
"I think maybe I do remember," Marianne said. "He came late, straight from Munich."
Benita shrugged and kept her eyes on the buttons she was counting.
"Could be. He was a particular friend of Connie's,"
Marianne persisted.
"That doesn't mean I would know him,"
Benita said.
"No,"
Marianne looked down.
"Well, we will find out who she is soon enough."
Chapter 8. Berglinginfels, August 1945.
To Anya Grabarek, it was clear that the woman leading them out of the Tollingen displaced persons camp was accustomed to giving orders. She had a wide, confident stride and the sort of commanding tone Anya was not used to hearing from members of her own sex. Even her name conveyed forcefulness. Marianne Falkenberg von Lingenfels.
"Your father was a brave man,"
the woman said over her shoulder to Anya's boys.
"It is my honor to host his family."
Anya glanced at her sons with their pale, thin faces. They looked stricken. Fear and confusion had rendered them mute.
Poor Anselm had barely spoken since Dresden, and Wolfgang, her baby, her fierce one,
had fallen into the sullen glower of a trapped animal.
Frau von Lingenfels moved on to the next subject.
Then suddenly she stopped.
"What's this?"
They were passing a low building from which people emerged like ghosts, covered in acrid-smelling gray chemical dust. The camp's delousing hall.
"Decontamination,"
Anya answered.
"Horrible,"
Frau von Lingenfels exclaimed.
"There must be a more humane way."
She was clearly a do-gooder, an advocate. It made Anya wary. At the gate, a young man in a UNRRA badge waved them past. This was the agency in charge of Europe's DP camps, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. It seemed to Anya a miracle that such an agency could exist. The line of new entries waiting to be processed stretched down the road. Every day more people arrived from the east. Ethnic Germans expelled from territories annexed by Russia and Poland. Some who had settled there at Hitler's urging. Some whose families had lived there for centuries. Russian Cossacks who had fought alongside the Nazis. Ukrainian nationalists who had fought against the Russians, and anyone else fearing Stalin's wrath. Last month, the camp had run out of beds. Now, new arrivals waited to be assigned local hosts, who would provide them a place to sleep under their own roofs. Usually, these hosts were reluctant at best. But not Marianne von Lingenfels. She had volunteered to host the Grabareks. In fact, she had sought them out. They were meant to be grateful, Anya understood. But she wasn't. She preferred the anonymity of the camp.
"You speak without an accent."
F.
Frau von Lingenfels said as they started in the opposite direction of the waiting people.
Are you originally German?
Anya nodded.
Ah,
the woman said.
But your husband was Polish.
Anya nodded again.
And you speak German too?
Frau von Lingenfels continued, turning to the boys.
What are your names?
The boys remained silent. Anselm sent an anxious look in his mother's direction. Wolfgang glared at the ground.
This is Anselm, and this is Wolfgang,
Anya supplied. The woman remained oblivious.
Well, you will meet two other young men about your ages at our castle. My boy, Fritz, who is 8, and his friend, Martin, who is 6. Another child of a resistor. I am sure you will become great friends. Burglingenfels is not a castle as you might imagine,
she continued cheerfully.
It's not grand. We live in the kitchen, really, because the rest of the place is empty and damp. And there's no more fine furniture. No one has lived in it for ages. But it has its advantages. A roof, for instance.
She laughed.
And a great big oven we can light when it's cold. And there were once little princes and princesses living in it, learning to joust and eating off golden plates and whatnot. Or anyway, my children like this idea.
Anya let the woman's words roll over her. They were going to a castle to live with a widow of the resistance, as Marianne von Lingenfels referred to herself. Thrushes sang from the grass. Poppies bloomed in the field. There was no checkpoint, no scrape of strafers, no tromp of boots. This was the important thing.
Before the war, the castle belonged to my husband's great-aunt,
Frau von Lingenfels continued.
She didn't live in it, but she organized parties there and picnics. She was something of an eccentric. Your father met her once. He was there for one of her parties.
She grew serious.
That was the only time I met him. Did he tell you anything about it? Countess von Lingenfels? Albrecht, my husband? Or Connie Fledermann?
No. Anya shook her head.
Your husband was in the Polish Foreign Office before the war. He was in the military.
Ah. Frau von Lingenfels nodded.
And then in the Home Army.
Anya nodded.
Was he arrested by the Nazis, or killed in the fighting?
He was sent to a camp. A look of remorse, even pity, crossed the woman's face.
I'm sorry, she said. Albrecht always felt guilty that we were not able to do more to support the Home Army, that he was imprisoned before the uprising.
Anya was silent. No checkpoints, no strafers, no stomping boots, she reminded herself. Dinner consisted of potatoes, cabbage, and mushrooms the children had gathered in the forest. And, luxury of luxuries, 3 boiled eggs. At the camp, the Grabareks had eaten thin gruel and spinach soup every day. This was a more lavish meal than they had seen in half a year. The eggs, apparently, were a gift from the farmer at the base of the hill, a man named Herr Kellermann, whom Frau von Lingenfels referred to as our hero, with a glibness Anya understood was meant to be kind.
But the eggs should be for you, not us,
Anya said stiffly, dredging up a trace of manners she had learned in another life. Anselm and Wolfgang looked alarmed.
Nonsense, Marianne said. You need them. We take turns.
Besides Frau von Lingenfels, there were her 2 daughters, one dark and solemn, the other lighter-haired, tall, and skeptical. And her son, a sturdy boy of about Wolfgang's age who would not sit still. And another woman and her son. The last 2 were confusing to her. Benita and Martin Fledermann. They too were refugees, Anya understood.
Their husband and father had also been executed by Hitler for his role in the July 20th conspiracy. The rest of the connection was lost. Frau von Lingenfels had grown up with him, or her husband had grown up with Frau Fledermann, or someone had known someone as a child. The von Lingenfels children spoke too fast. Frau von Lingenfels assumed too much. Their words raced over Anya like water from a hose. They too had come from the east, from Silesia. First, they had gone to Berlin. There had been an illness. There was a list of widows. Other wives of resistors. She, Anya Grabarek, was the second one they had found. The first was Frau Fledermann. Anselm and Wolfgang kept their eyes down. Anya nodded and ate. Frau Fledermann and her son were also silent. Both were pale and blonde and beautiful. She in the fragile way of an injured bird, and he like a blinking, quietly startled fawn. They were not at ease here either. This made Anya like them. When the von Lingenfelses were done telling, they began with the questions.
"Were you taken to a children's home, like Martin?"
Fritz asked Anselm.
"Were you in a KZ?"
Anselm shook his head no.
"Were you in Warsaw when it was bombed? Was it worse than Berlin? Were the Russian soldiers as cruel as everyone says?"
Anselm and Wolfgang shook their heads, focused on their eggs. No, no, and a shrug. They fielded the questions with one-word answers, shoveling food into their mouths. In the last months, they had become animals, used to sleeping in the open, foraging for sustenance, guarding against predators. Anya felt exhaustion settle over her. If she closed her eyes for even a moment, she was certain she would fall asleep.
"Enough,"
Frau von Lingenfels announced, pushing back her chair.
"We are overwhelming our guests. Elisabeth and Katharina, wash up. Fritz and Martin, bring in water. Grabarex, go to bed."
With relief, Anya led her boys upstairs to the small room they had been assigned above the kitchen. In the middle, two mattresses were covered with sheets and two blankets each. When was the last time Anya and her boys had slept on sheets? The beauty of this, the simple sign of order and cleanliness, tightened her throat. She remembered learning to fold sheets as a girl, to wrap them around the mattress, pulling the corners just so. A realm of knowledge rendered meaningless over the previous months.
"Mama?"
Anselm's voice floated out of the darkness. Disconnected from his body, which had grown tall and wiry, it sounded childish, a reminder that he was only 9.
"Are you going to tell them?"
Anya jolted awake.
"Tell them what?"
Wolfgang demanded before she could speak.
"That you don't want to stay here. That you want to go back to the camp."
His voice was surprisingly harsh. Of the two, he was the leader despite the fact that he was younger.
"No,"
Anselm said meekly. And then,
"Mama."
Anya was silent. Through the dark, she could feel both boys waiting for her to respond. Outside, an owl hooted in the dark.
"Hush," she said finally. "Time to sleep."
Chapter 9. The Vartigo, January 1945. In sleep, Anya returns to the march. Not so much in her dreams as in her memory. It waits there for her to relive, a weird middle point. The journey from one life to another, her personal metamorphosis. The road to Breslau teems with refugees. Mothers, children, old people, sisters. All flee before the advancing Red Army. Some are from as far away as the Black Sea and have been on the road for months. There are few men among them, only the crippled, sick, and elderly. The war is not over yet, and the rest of the men are fighting. For the Germans, the Russians, the local partisans, or whoever is the most expedient to fight for. Even more of them are dead. Occasionally,